Chapter 4. The Ustyuli Plains. A quote from a Canaan proverb. All ropes come up short if pulled long enough. All futures end in tragedy. A quote from Isuphirus. And they forged counterfeits from our frame, creatures vile and obscene, who hungered only for violent congress. These beasts they loosed upon the land, where they multiplied, no matter how fierce the Ishroi who hunted them. And soon men clamored at our gates, begging sanctuary, for they could not contend with the creatures. "Beware your face," the penitents cried. "This calamity is your issue." But we were wroth, and turned them away, saying, "These are not our sons, and you are not our brothers." Spring, 20 New Imperial Year, 4132, Year of the Tusk, the High Ustyuli. The company of Scions picked its way across the broad back of Iarwa. The days passed without any visible sign of having traveled whatsoever. They had been charged with trolling the grasslands to the southwest, with the hope of finding game they could drive back to the army of the Middle North. They did not see so much as a hoofprint. They could scarce feed themselves as the days passed, let alone an army. The parching wind continued to blow, kneading scalps and hair with warm fingers, hissing through the dead scrub that bristled the endless plait of the Ustyuli. Even though they rode with purpose, it seemed they drifted. Such was the expanse surrounding them. The land was devoid of track or direction, and so vast that Sorwheel often found himself hunching in his saddle, cringing in the dim way of bodily fears. He was bred to the plains, to open endless skies, and even still he felt shrunken, soft, and exposed. Men tend to forget the world's true proportion, to think the paltry measure of their ambition can plumb the horizon. It is a genius of theirs. But some lands, by dint of monumental heights or sheer, stark emptiness, contradict this conceit, remind them that they are never so big as the obstacles the world might raise against them. For watch after watch, Sorwheel rode, with the itch of his reminiscence floating within him. No distraction could scratch it away, not even Aeschylus at his worst. To his chagrin, the rotund schoolmen insisted on practicing language drills, no matter who was in their vicinity, Zaranga and Obategwa, more often than not. On one occasion the entire company took up his chant, shouting Shaic numerals across the plains, while Sorwheel gazed about in despair and disgust. Aeschylus seemed to find the spectacle horribly amusing, as did Zaranga, for that matter. The mandate schoolman proved as much a source of embarrassment as irritation. His mere presence rendered Sorwheel a schoolboy, though the man insisted he had been sent as much to chaperone the entire company as to tutor the woefully ignorant King Sorwheel of Sarkarpus. "The Holy Aspect Emperor takes his enemies seriously," the sorceress said with a glib twinkle in his eye, "and his enemies take their children seriously." Sorwheel found the comment at once laughable and troubling. Aeschylus, with his foppish 3 C's beard and portly stature, not to mention his lack of armor or weaponry, seemed almost absurdly defenseless and ineffectual. Another soft-pawed Lunaral. And yet Sorwheel had no reason to doubt the truth of what he said, that he had been sent to safeguard their company, especially after witnessing the sorcerous destruction of Sarkarpus. At night Sorwheel could almost pretend, when he kept his eyes hooked to the starry heavens, that none of what happened had happened, that the droning voices belonged to his father and his uncles, not the sons of exotic lands and distant kings. This was the time of the lioning, when the Saglanders planted their crops, and when the male members of the House of Verult and their boonsmen rode out into the mountains in search of puma. Since his 12th summer, he had accompanied his father and his uncles, and he adored every moment of it, even though his youth chained him to the hunting camp with his cousins. And he loved nothing more than lying with his eyes closed, listening to his father speak before the late-night fire, not as a king, but as a man among others. The lioning was how he learned his father was truly funny and genuinely beloved by his men. So he would lie with these memories, curl about their warmth. But whenever it seemed he could believe, some dread would lurch out of the nethers and pretense and blow away like smoke before gusting apprehensions. Saranga, the Aspect Emperor, and the mother most of all. One question more than any other dominated the crowded commons of his soul. What? What does she want? And it would be the she who appalled him the most, who filled his bowel with nervous water. She, Yatwer, the mother of birth. He spent many sleepless watches simply hefting the vertiginous weight of this fact in his thoughts. He found it strange the way one could kneel, even pray with sobbing intensity, and yet never ponder, let alone comprehend, what lay behind the ancient names. Yatwer. What did that holy sound mean? The priests of the Hundred were dark and severe, every bit as harsh as the Tusk prophets they took as their examples. They brandished the names of their gods the way stern fathers raised whips. Obedience was all they asked for, all they expected. The rest fell out of their hard readings of hard scriptures. For Sorweel, Yatwer had always been dark and nebulous, something too near the root of things, too aboriginal, not to be filled with the sense of peril, belonging to sudden knives and fatal falls. All children come to temple with a fear of smallness, which the priests then work and knead like clay, shaping it into the strange reconciliation to horror that is religious devotion, the sense of loving something too terrible to countenance, too hoary to embrace. When he thought about the world beyond what his eyes could see, he saw souls in their innumerable thousands, with only frayed threads to hold them, dangling over the gaping black of the outside, and the shadows moving beneath. The gods, ancient and capricious, reptilian with indifference, with designs so old and vast that there could only be madness in the small eyes of men. And none were so old or so pitiless as the dread Mother of Birth. That was what her name was, childhood terror. To be pinched between such things, Yatwer and the Aspect Emperor, gods and demons. Somehow he had been pulled into the world's threshing wheels, the grinding immensities. Small wonder he had been so eager to escape the clamor of the great ordeal. Small wonder the traveling sway of his pony, stubborn, carried the promise of deeper escape. He posed the question to Zaranga and his impromptu court one night, careful to conceal the intensity of his interest. Fires were, of course, forbidden, so they sat side by side, facing south, alternately staring into their hands and into the starry heavens. The kings and princes of lands cowed, but not quite conquered by the new empire, yearning for homes thrown far over the night horizon. Obutegwa sat dutifully behind them, translating when needed. If anything spurred Sorweel in his language lessons with Aeschylus, it was the burden his stupidity had become for the wise old obligate. They had been discussing omens and portents, how more and more signs seemed to inveigh against the Aspect Emperor. None more so than the persisting drought. Karampa, in particular, was convinced that the Anasarimber dynasty's doom was imminent. They overreach! Think of their gall! How could they not be punished? I ask you, I ask you! Singh seemed inclined to agree, and as always, no one could fathom Tenurit's opinion, or whether his smile was in fact a sneer for that matter. Saranga, however, remained skeptical. What happens, Sorweel finally ventured, if we fail the gods simply because we don't know what they demand? Kasaku Alaman, Obutegwa began droning from behind him. Damnation, Zing replied. The gods care nothing for our excuses. No, Zaranga snapped, loud enough to preempt Karampa's eager reply. only if we fail to properly honor our ancestors. The heavens are like palaces, Horse King. One does not need the king's permission to enter.
Pah! Karampa cried,
as much to avenge his interruption as otherwise, Soriel suspected. Here I thought the Zayumi were too sensible to believe that Enrithi nonsense.
No, it is not Enrithi nonsense. Honoring ancestors is far older than the thousand temples.
You Kingi are as bad as the sausages, Saranga turned to the young king of Sekarpus. Family survives death. Don't let this fool tell you different.
Yes, Sorweel replied, listening far too keenly to what was said. This was what it meant to be a conquered people, a part of him realized. To turn to foreign beliefs of foreign peoples.
But what if your family is damned?
The successor prince watched him appreciatively.
Trempe Usmar,
then you must do everything in your power to discover what the gods do want.
Everything.
Though Zaranga was not overly pious, Sorweel knew from previous discussions that the Zayumi had a far different way, not so much of conceiving life and death as valuing them, a way that made them seem zealots on occasion. Even the peculiarities of Obutegwa's interpretations revealed as much. The Zayumi used two versions of the same word to speak of life and death, words that roughly translated into small life and great life, with death being the latter.
Otherwise?
The successor prince looked at Sorweel as if he were searching for something.
Grounds for trust?
Otherwise you were lost. The world seems greater in the morning, and men smaller. The ground shrank beneath the rising sun, scalded into white blindness, so that it seemed they woke on the very edge of creation. Raised hands shielded eyes, broke back grasses cast shadows like black wire. Sorweel had grown up in this country. Its imprint lay deep in his soul, so deep that simply looking at it braced him, like legs in a wide stance for his soul. Even still, it dizzied him to think how far they had ridden beyond the pale. He had been educated, of course, and so knew the pale for what it was, the northern terminus of Sekarpic power, and not the point where waking reality tipped into nightmares. But the superstitions of the rabble had a way of steaming upward, of soaking the more worldly understanding of the nobility. Despite his tutors, the pale remained a kind of moral boundary in his imagination, the line that marked the fading of the good and the gathering of what was evil. Enough to catch his breath when he thought of the miles between him and his holy city. For a company as small as theirs to ride the emptiness as they did, a nagging part of him insisted, was nothing short of madness. If anything silenced these worries, it was his growing respect for Captain Harnilus. He had not thought much of old Harney at first. Like many other Saiyans, he had tried to detest the man, if not for who he was, then for what he represented. Diminishing others is ever the way men raise themselves, and the might of the Aspect Emperor was such. The glory and the competence of the Kidruhil so obvious that petty targets like Harnilus seemed to be the only ones remaining. But the captain was nothing if not dogged in his warlike wisdom. Gruff, bearded in manner, even though he shaved like so many of his Nancer countrymen, his scars picked up where his wrinkles left off, so that his face seemed tattooed with different sigils, depending on the angle and intensity of the light. He so obviously cared so little for what his wards thought of them, that they could not but esteem him.
In Zayum, Zaranga once said, we call men like him Nukbaru, masons, stone-hewers.
After Obutegwa finished translating, the successor prince nodded toward the head of their small column.
Our captain.
When Sorweel asked him why, Zaranga smiled and said,
because to hew stone you must be stronger than stone.
Or smarter, Aeschylus had added. Riding as they did had a way of nursing and smothering conversations. Sometimes they chattered as loudly as wives filing from temple. Sometimes they rode in desert silence, with only the arrhythmic gait of their ponies to punctuate the perpetual wind. Usually their talk would be momentary,
sparking here, fading there, as though a single animate spirit drifted through them all, drawing thought into voice, one by one. The morning of their 10th day of ranging, they embarked in silence and continued riding that way. They sighted the elk trail before noon, a mottled water stain across the linen distances, as broad as a valley. They did not reach it until early afternoon, a thin file of cavalrymen picking their way across the land battered by a thousand hoofs, a trail as great as any of the world's enormities. Sorweel cursed himself for a fool. Such was his relief. The following day began the same as any other. The elk trail continued its southern arc, resembling the imprint of a curved sword left overlong in the grass, only writ across the entire landscape. The scions filed through its great trampled heart, silent, save for the clink of gear and the warbling of one or two desultory conversations. Even Karampa seemed disinclined to speak. Sorweel rocked in his saddle like the others, listening to the sweep of wind and the low ghost noises it made when it caught his ears. The first shouts came from the head of the column. A pair of vultures had been sighted to their left. The entire company rode perched in their saddles, fingers pointing, eyes scanning the wandering line of the eastern horizon. The plain seemed to curl and fold more and more as it diminished in the haze, like a mangy carpet kicked against a wall. The sky rose high and endless above. "We've found our herd!" Obategwa cried, translating Zaranga's jubilant words. Sorweel blinked and squinted, his face angled against the sun's glare. He found and tracked the two floating specks, even glimpsed the bar of wings, riding faraway winds. Before he knew what he was doing, he spurred stubborn into a gallop. The pony leapt into its stride with almost dog-like exuberance. The scions watched with curiosity and amusement as he pounded to the fore of the line. Captain Harnilas was already scowling at him when he reined stubborn to a reluctant halt. "Marus pavuta jegazum!" the old cavalryman shouted. "Captain!" Sorweel cried in Shaik. With a sweeping gesture he directed the man's grizzled attention toward the horizon. Then, as emphatically as he could, he spoke the one word that transcended all the languages of men. "Shrank!" He matched the officer's hard gaze, noticing, not for the first time, the scar on his cheek, burned, puckered as though he had once shed a fiery tear. For the first time he saw the small soapstone figurines hanging about his neck. Three children joined at the hands and feet, chipping across his cuirass. A strange sense of recognition welled through the young king, a realization that Harnilas, despite his exotic complexion and furious brown eyes, was not so different than his father's boonsman, that he chambered his heart, as so many warlike men did, to keep his sense clear of his compassion. Harnilas loved, as all men loved, in the cracks and crevices of a warring world. Aeschylus finally trotted into earshot, gasping as though his pony had ridden him instead of otherwise. Sorweel turned to the schoolman. "Tell him to study those birds carefully. Tell him that they're storks, the most holy of birds. Tell him that storks only follow Shrank on the plain." Aeschylus frowned in his thoughtful way, then relayed the information to Captain Harnilas. Aside from a quick glance at the sorcerer, he continued to watch Sorweel intently. "Shrank," the captain repeated. The leathery face turned to squint at the specks floating in the distant sky. Sorweel pursed his lips and nodded. "The bird is holy!" "Your tutor argues that the Shrank should be left to him," old Obotegwe explained, "so that no lives need be lost. Harnilas disagrees. He thinks the scions need practice, even at the cost of their lives. Better to begin with easy blooding, he says, than a hard one." They had gradually closed on the high circling storks over the course of the afternoon, taking care to remain upwind, and to use the creases in the broken plain to keep their approach hidden. If Sorweel had entertained any fears regarding Harnilas, they had been allayed by the patient sensibility of his tactics,
and the thoughtless ease with which he exercised his command. After ascertaining the direction of their march, he angled their pursuit to better intercept their trail. They now knew they followed a warband of some 300, a number too small to suggest a migrating clan. They had almost been sighted twice now, crossing the crest of some knoll at the same time as their inhuman quarry. But they had managed to close within a mile of the warband. The sun had smoldered into evening, scorching the western horizon gold and crimson. Now the company of Saiyans sheltered in a trough of cool shadow, watching Aeschylus argue with their captain. The afternoon had been tense, certainly, but far more thrilling than anything else. With the possible exception of the Skilvendi Tinuret, the Saiyans rode with grins whipped across their face. A kind of glee had possessed them, one that sparked low snorts of laughter whenever glances were exchanged, childlike in that sneaking way, murderous in its ultimate intent. For his own part, Sorweel felt none of the fear, not a whisper of the cowardice that he had thought would unman him. A limb-gripping eagerness filled him instead, a will to ride down and kill. Even his pony, stubborn, seemed to sense the impending violence, and to welcome it. Of course Aeschylus was intent on ruining everything. Blasphemer, Sorweel found himself thinking. Sorweel had no real idea how much influence his tutor wielded. Mandate schoolmen were rumored to be more powerful than judges, but whether this extended to the field, or to Kidrahill companies particularly, he did not know. He could only hope that their surly old captain prevailed. Harnellus did not strike him as a particularly political man, which was probably why he had been given the Saiyans in the first place. Sorweel's father had told him several times that intriguing killed far more men on the field than otherwise. The two middle-aged men waved hands and shouted for several moments more. Then Aeschylus apparently said something either too clever or too impertinent. Harnellus stood in his stirrups and began thundering at the sorcerer, who fairly wilted before the savage display. Sorweel found himself laughing with Saranga and Obategua.
"Fool!"
Aeschylus cried in corpulent exasperation as he rejoined them. "The man is a fool!"
"Practice, practice," Sorweel sang, mimicking the tone the schoolman took whenever he groaned about language drills. "You're the one always saying the easy way is never the proper way."
Saranga chortled at Obategua's translation. The schoolman glared at Sorweel for an angry moment, then collected himself with a harried smile. He looked up to the storks circling high above a crest that bowled the earth before them. Their white spans carried sunset gold. "I pray you prove me right, my king, I really do." A chill seemed to creep into the shadow. Once decided, their pursuit became determined. At Harnillus's gestured command, they fell into wedge formation, rode the rising and falling knolls like a loose-jointed raft on ocean swells. They trotted to prevent winding their horses, a pace that allowed for more than a little excited chatter, though the anxiousness of cresting each rise knocked them into gazing silence. "They don't move," Saranga said through Obategua.
"Why? Have they seen us?"
"Could be," Sorweel replied, fighting against the breathlessness that pinched his voice. "Or they could be resting. Shrink prefer the night. Sun exhausts them."
"Then why not use the high ground where they can keep watch?"
"The sun," he repeated, speaking through a pang of sudden apprehension. "They hate the sun."
"And we hate the night, which is why we double our watches."
The Sarkarpi king nodded. "But no man has walked this land for thousands of years, remember? Why should they keep watch for myths and legends?" His earlier eagerness seemed to slip out of him, plummet through the soles of his boots. They climbed a slope, riding into their shadows at an angle to the dust that peeled away from them. Everywhere he looked, he saw ground, and yet it seemed he rode the lip of a perilous chasm. Vertigo leaned out from him, threatened to pull him from his saddle. There was no certainty, he realized. Anything could happen on the field of war. Anything. A keening noise climbed into the earth and thunder of their advance, high and ragged, as though cutting the throats that were its crying origin.
The storks seemed to hang in the air directly above them, lines of virgin white etched in the sun. The Scion swung through the shadow of the shallow basin, scraping through the haze of brush and dead grasses, then raced upward. The Knoll's crown met their rush. The sun broke across their backs, crimson flashing from silver and crimson. The shrieking chorus collapsed into squeals and yammering alarms. The Shrank mobbed the spaces below them, a putrid congregation scattered across the gap between sunlit summits. Thin white arms yanked at weapons, faces collapsed into squints of fury. Clan standards, human skulls, haired with bison hide, jerked and wagged. Sorweel did not need to look down the line of his fellows to know their faces. Disbelief is ever the door between young men and murder. An impossible moment followed, one Sorweel had heard various horse lords mention from time to time. The line of lancers, their helms and mailed sleeves gleaming in the sunlight, stood motionless, save for the most anxious of ponies. The Shrank band roiled with shriek and gesture, but likewise did not move. The two parties simply regarded each other, not out of hesitation, and certainly not for calculation's sake. It was more a warlike epipoise, as if the encounter were a coin spinning in the air, needing only the hard ground of murder to judge. Sorweel lifted himself forward to whisper in Stubborn's ear, "One and one are one." And they were off, shouting the war cries of a dozen heathen nations, a thundering, trampling line, a flying rake of lance points. From the stories his father's boonsmen told him, he had expected each heartbeat to last an age. But in fact everything happened fast, far too fast to be terrifying, or exhilarating, or anything for that matter. One heartbeat, the Shrank were a tangle of sprinting forms before him, skin white, armor black with filth, iron weapons wild in the air. The next heartbeat, he was crashing through them like something thrown. His lance glanced off the corner of a shield, skewered the throat of a wagging creature he had not even seen, let alone intended to kill. The heartbeat after, he was drawing his sword, reining Stubborn about, and hacking. Shrieks and cries and shouts pealed skyward. The dreadful clatter of war. Seven, maybe eight, threshing heartbeats passed. He wondered at the ease with which sword points punctured faces, no different from practice melons. Otherwise, he was his blade, his horse, dancing between the jabber of pale shadows, raining ruin and destruction. Purple blood jetted, flew back across the dead scrub. Then it was just the low dust, the clutched of the maimed and the dying, and a cacophony that moved beyond him, continued moving. He spurred Stubborn in pursuit, glimpsed Saranga grinning from a passing saddle. The surviving Shrank ran before an uneven wave of horsemen, a kind of jerking scramble. Sorweel seized a lance, jutting from the ground as he galloped past, leaned into Stubborn's exertions. He quickly overtook the laggards among the Scions, soon found himself in the pounding fore of the pursuit. A crazed grin seized his lips. He howled his people's ancient war cry, the lung-cracking sound that had marked innumerable such pursuits through the ages. The Shrank ran, bolting through dead scrub like wolverines, opening the interval between them and the slowest of the Scions. Only the quickest of the quick overtook them. There was joy in the race. His legs and hips had become mere extensions of Stubborn's leaping gallop, the ground pouring away like water, his hand gripping his lance, loosely as he had been taught from childhood, floating, tingling, as if he held a thunderbolt. He was a son of Sacarpus, a horse lord, and this was his calling. He struck with a viciousness that seemed holy for its thoughtlessness. One in the neck, rolling limbs, akimbo into caged bracken. Another in the heel, left limp running, mewling like a knifed cat. Anything he overran he instantly forgot, knowing that the pounding wall behind him would eat them up. They scattered and he followed. There was no hiding beneath the shining plain's sun. They bent their white faces back to him as he closed.
black eyes glittering, features pinched, ancient with fear and fury, their limbs little more than a flutter of shadows in the grass-thatched dust. They coughed. They screamed as they spun falling. There was joy in the race, ecstasy in the kill. One and one were one. Their victory was complete. Among the Saiyans, three were fallen, and some nine others were wounded, including Karampa, who took a spear in his thigh. Despite the dark looks thrown by Escalese, old Harney was obviously satisfied with his young wards, perhaps even proud of them. Sorwheel had witnessed death enough during his city's fall. He knew what it meant to watch familiar faces spit their final breath. But for the first time, he experienced the jarring of elation and regret that comes with triumph in the field. For the first time, he understood the contradiction that blackens the heart of all martial glory. His fellows cheered him, clapped his back and shoulders. Zaronga even embraced him, a kind of madness cackling in his wide green eyes. Stunned, Sorwheel climbed the hump of the nearest knoll, stared out across the plains. The sun lay on the horizon, burning crimson through a band of violet, dousing the innumerable crests and low summits in pale orange. He stood and breathed. He thought of his ancient fathers wandering as he did across these lands, killing those who did not belong. He thought of the way his boots rooted him to the earth. The darkening sky was so broad that it seemed to spin with slow vertigo. The nail of heaven glittered, and the world towered beneath. That night Harnilas indulged them, knowing that they were boys drunk on the deeds of men. The last of the Inanni rum was uncorked, and each of them was granted two burning swallows. They took one of the surviving abominations and staked it to the turf. At first scruples held them back, for among the Saiyans were even more a few ewes of gentle breeding. They would do no more than kick the shrieking creature. Disgusted, Sorwheel finally knelt over the shrunk's white head and put out one of its eyes. Some among the Saiyans hooped and cheered, but more cried out in consternation, even outrage, saying that such torture was a crime against Jenain, what they called their effeminate and obscure laws of conduct. The young king of Sarkarpus turned to his fellows in disbelief. The creature thrashed across the ground immediately behind him. Captain Harnilas strode to his side, and all fell in silent expectation. "Tell them," he said to Sorwheel, speaking slowly that he might understand. "Explain their foolishness to them." More than 80 faces watched, a moonlit congregation. Sorwheel swallowed, glanced at Obutegwa, who simply nodded, and stepped to his side. "They come," he began, only to falter at the sound of Escalese translating in Obutegwa's stead. "They come in winter, mostly, especially when the ground freezes too hard for them to scrounge the grubs that are their staple, sometimes in single clans, sometimes in shrieking hordes. The towers of the Pale are strong for this reason, and the horse lords have become reavers beyond compare. But every year at least one tower is overcome. At least one. The men are slaughtered, mostly. But the women, and the children particularly, are taken for sport. Sometimes we find their severed heads nailed to doors and walls. Little girls, little boys, infants. We never find them whole, and their blood is always thrust from them. Instead of crimson, the dead are smeared black. Black," and his voice broke upon this word, "with seed." Sorwheel stopped, his face flushed, his fingers trembling. In his 14th winter, his father had brought him north on a punitive expedition to see their ancient and implacable enemy firsthand. Hoping to find supplies and accommodation, they had come to a tower called Grojahald, only to find it sacked. The horrors he had seen there haunted his dreams still.
We could torment 1,000 of these creatures for 1,000 years, his father had told him that night, and we could have repaid but a droplet of the anguish they have visited upon us. He repeated those words now. Sorwheel was not accustomed to addressing men in numbers, and so he took the silence that followed as a kind of condemnation. When Aeschylus continued speaking, he simply assumed the schoolman tried to undo his foolishness. Then Obategwa, translating the sorcerer, muttered, "King Sorwheel speaks as eloquently as he speaks true." Sorwheel was shocked to find he could follow much of what the mandate schoolman said. "Shush Sharakum. These are beasts without souls. They are flesh without spirit. Obscenities like no other. Each of them is a pit, a hole in the very fundament. Where we possess feelings, where we possess love and hate and weep, they are void. Cut them, rend them, burn and drown them. You sooner wrong dirt than sin against these vile abominations." As strong as these words sounded, Sorwheel noticed that most of the Saiyans continued to regard him rather than the schoolman, and he realized that what he had thought was condemnation was in fact something entirely different. Respect, admiration even. Only Zaranga seemed to watch him with troubled eyes. The sport began in earnest after that. The mannish laughter was as shrill as the inhuman screams were crazed. What was left twitched and glistened in the blood-sodden grasses. They broke camp discussing the strange absence of vultures, then rode out into the broad light of the plains. To a soul they had discussed the previous day's battle, boasting of kills, comparing nicks, and laughing at gaffes. The Saiyans thought themselves veterans, but their talk remained that of boys. Easy victories, as a horse lord would say. Grow no beards. They recovered the elk trail without difficulty, followed it beneath an afternoon sun rendered small for the gaping horizon. They caught the reek on the wind before seeing anything. It was a wide smell, a rot that reached as far as the air. The vista rose into view in inexorable stages, the far corners, swaths of dun and blackened bone, buttressing the line of the horizon. Then the welter of nearer regions, too still, too silent. The company of Saiyans assembled along the crest of a low ridge, 87 of them abreast, the men slack-faced, the ponies nodding and stamping in equine anxiousness. Their Kidrahil standard, the black circumfix, and golden horse, flapped and waved against endless blue. Aside from coughs and curses, none possessed the will to speak. Carcasses. Fields of them, dead elk soaking the dust black. Vultures hunched like priests beneath cowls, or raised wings in imperious accusation. In any given heartbeat, dozens could be seen dropping from the skies across points near and miles away. Their cries rose hoarse through a great buzzing hum. Flies. So many they appeared as living smoke across the distances. An elk carcass lay gutted not far from Sorwheel, its guts strewn like rotted clothes. Several feet beyond lay a clutch of three more, ribs cracked out from articulated spines. Beyond that lay another, and yet another, ribs opened like gigantic traps. On and on and on, 1,000 circles of gore across the wasted pasture. Captain Harnilus called out, and the company of Saiyans descended the slope in formation, opening only to skirt the carcasses. The nearest vultures screeched at their approach, a kind of reptilian outrage, then took to the wind. Sorwheel watched them anxiously, knowing that others would use their ascent to track their progress from miles away. "What kind of madness is this?" Zaranga murmured from his side. Sorwheel did not need Aeschylus's translation to understand. "Shrenk," the schoolman said, his voice curiously tight. "A hoarding." Sorwheel glimpsed the creatures in his soul's eye, hacking and tearing, stabbing the beasts still living, then coupling with shining wounds. A shrieking landscape of them,
In ancient days, his mandate tutor continued, before the coming of the No God, the Shrank would continually retreat before hosts too powerful for any one clan to assault. Back and back, clan heaped upon clan, until their hunger forced them to take game, until their numbers blackened the very earth.
And then, Sorweel asked,
they attacked.
So all this time,
a grim nod. The clans had been driven before the great ordeal and its rumor, accumulating, like water before the prow of a boat.
Hoarding,
Sorweel repeated,
weighing the term on his tongue. Does Harney know about this?
We shall know soon enough, the corpulent schoolman said. Without further word, he spurred his overtaxed pony to overtake the Kidruhil captain. Sorweel allowed his gaze to range across the ground before the company, saw strings of blood flung across the scree, welters of cracked bone and skulls, some with the eyes sucked out, others with cheeks chewed away to the snout. No matter where he looked, he saw another gory circle. The largest Shrank clans the Horse Lords battled rarely numbered more than several hundred. Sometimes a particularly cruel and cunning Shrank chieftain would enslave his neighbors, and open warfare would range across the Pale. And the legends were littered with stories of Shrank rising in nations and overcoming the outermost holds. Sekarpis itself had been besieged 5 times since the days of the Ruiner. But this... slaughter. Only some greater power could have accomplished this. Meat sweated in open sunlight. Flies steamed about the scrub and grasses. Cartilage gleamed, where not chapped with gore. The stink was raw, onto gagging.
The war is real, he said with dull wonder. The Aspect Emperor. His war is real.
Perhaps, Saranga said after listening to Obategwa's translation. But are his reasons? Otherwise you were utterly lost. So, Saranga had said. Despite the clamor and triumph of the past days, these words continued to sink and to surface through the young king's turbulent soul. He had no reason to doubt them. For all his youth, Saranga possessed what the Sekarpi call
Phil.
Salt. The fact was, Yatwar, the patroness of the weak and the dispossessed, had chosen him, even though he had been betrothed to her brother, Gilgale, since his 5th summer, even though he possessed the blood of warriors, even though he was what the Yatwarians called Weryield, a taker, a thief by virtue of his bones. Railing against the absurdity, let alone the shame, of her choice did nothing but prove him worthy of the humiliation. He had been chosen. Now he only needed to know why. Otherwise... Prosperian was the obvious answer. It seemed clear now that the slave was a secret priest of some kind. Sorweel had always thought that only women attended to the worldly interests of the Ur-mother. But he scarcely knew anything of the low and mean peoples of his own nation, let alone the ways of those a world away. The more he considered it, the more he felt a fool for not realizing as much earlier. Prosperian had come to him bearing this terrible burden. He was the one to tell him what that burden was, and whither it should be borne. That was, if Sorweel could learn to wrap his tongue and ears around Sheik. That night, while the others slept, the young king of Sekarpis rolled to his side on his sleeping mat, and, in the way anxious bodies choose small tasks of their own volition, started picking the grasses before him. Prosperian, his cheeks rutted like withered apples, his eyes like wet chips of obsidian, floated beneath his soul's eye the entire time, spitting fire into his palm, rubbing mud into his cheeks. Only when he had bared a small patch of earth did Sorweel realize what he was doing. Molding the dread mother's face the way Prosperian had the day the Aspect Emperor had declared him a believer king. It seemed a kind of crazed game, one of those acts that send the intellect laughing, even as the stomach quails. He could not pitch and mold the way the Shigeki slave had, because the earth was so dry. So he raised the cheeks by cupping dust beneath his palms, sculpted the brow and nose with a trembling fingertip. He held his breath, clutched and shallow, lest he mar his creation with an errant exultation. He fussed over the work, even used the edge of his fingernail to render details. It was a numb and loving labor. When he was finished, he rested his head in the crook of his arm and gazed at the thing's shadowy profile, trying to blink away the deranged impossibility of it. For a mad moment, it seemed the whole of the world, all the obdurate miles he had traveled, multiplied on and on in every direction, was but the limbless body of the face before him. King Harweel's face. Sorweel hugged his shoulders with a wrestler's fury, grappled with the sobs that kicked through him. "Father," he cried on a murmur. "Son," the earthen lips croaked in reply. He felt himself bend back, as if he were a bow drawn by otherworldly hands.
"Water,"
the image coughed on a small cloud of dust. "Climbs the pro—"
Aeschylus's words?
Sorweel raised a crazed fist, dashed the face into the combed grasses. He neither slept nor lay awake. He waited in the in-between.
"So all this time," he heard himself ask Aeschylus, "the clans have been driven before the great ordeal, and its rumor accumulating, like water before the prow of a boat,
hoarding." Sorweel had seen few boats in his life, fishing holes, of course, and the famed river galley at Unterpa. He understood the significance of the sorcerer's description. The problem was that the Saiyans tracked game to the southwest of the Great Ordeal. So very far from the prow! He bided his time in turmoil. His body had lost its instinct for breathing, so he drew air in its stead. Never did the sun seem so long in climbing.
"With all due respect, my king," the sorceress said with a waking sneer, "kindly go fuck your elbows." Aeschylus was one of those men who never learned to bridle their temper simply because it was so rare. The sun had yet to breach the desolate line of the east, but the sky was brightening over the scattered sleepers. The sentries watched with frowning curiosity, as did several of the horses. Harnilas was awake as well, but Sorweel did not trust his sheikh enough to go to him directly.
"The Shrank war party we destroyed," Sorweel insisted. "It had no sentries posted."
"Please, boy," the corpulent man said. He rolled his bulk away from the young king. "Let me get back to my nightmares."
"It was alone, Aeschylus. Don't you see?"
He raised his puffy face to blink at him over his shoulder.
"What are you saying?"
"We lie to the southwest of the great ordeal. What kind of water piles behind a boat?"
The schoolman stared at him for a blinking, beard-scratching moment. Then, with a groan, rolled onto his rump. Sorweel helped haul him to his cursing feet, and together they went to Harnilas, who was already ministering to his pony. Aeschylus began by apologizing for Sorweel, something the young king had no patience for, especially when he could scarce understand what was being said.
"We're tracking an army!" he cried.
Both men looked at him in alarm. Harnilas glanced at Aeschylus for a translation, which the schoolman provided with scarce a glance in the captain's direction.
"What makes you say that?" he asked Sorweel in the same breath.
"These Shrank, the ones who cut down the elk, they are being driven."
"How could you know that?"
"We know this is no hoarding," the young king replied, breathing deep to harness his thoughts, which had become tangled for a long night of horror and brooding. "The Shrank, as you said, are even now fleeing before the great ordeal. Clan bumping into clan, gathering in a ho—"
"So?"
Aeschylus snapped.
"Think about it," he said. "If you were the consult,
You would know about the hoarding, would you not?
More than any living, the schoolman admitted, his voice taut with alarm. For Sorwheel, the word consult as yet possessed little meaning beyond the fear it sparked in the eyes of the Enrithi. But after the incident with the skin spy in Umbilicus, he had found it increasingly difficult to dismiss them as figments of the Aspect Emperor's madness, as with so many other things.
So they will not only know the great ordeal will be attacked, but when as well.
Very possibly, Aeschylus said. Sorwheel thought of his father, of all the times he had heard him reason with his subjects, let alone his men. To be a worthy king, Harwheel had once told him, is to lead, not to command. And he understood that all the bickering, all the discourse he had considered wasted breath, tongue-measuring, was in fact central to kingship.
Look, he said, we all know this expedition is a farce, that Ceuta sent us to patrol a rear flank that would never have been patrolled otherwise simply because we are the Scions, the sons of his father's enemies. We cover territory that a host would otherwise be blind to, a territory a cunning enemy would exploit. While patrolling this imaginary flank, we stumble across a war party with no sentries posted, oblivious enough to find respite in the shade. In other words, we find proof that for this corner of the Istuli, at least, the great ordeal does not exist.
He trailed to let the schoolman complete his translation.
Then we find the slaughtered elk, something you say shrank only due in hoarding, which we know cannot be the case.
So Will hesitated, looking from man to man, the stern old veteran and the square-bearded sorcerer.
You have our attention, my king, Aeschylus said. All I have are guesses, and we are dutifully astounded.
Sorwheel looked out over the milling ponies to the vast elk trail, which was little more than the mottling of darker grays across the pre-dawn landscape.
Somewhere. Out there.
My guess, he said, reluctantly turning back to the two men, is that we've stumbled across some kind of consult army, one that...
He paused to gulp air and swallow.
One that shadows the great ordeal, using the elk both to feed itself and to conceal their trail. My guess is they plan to wait until the great ordeal comes against the hoarding.
He swallowed and nodded, as if suddenly recalling some adolescent insecurity. He flinched from an image of his father, speaking dust from the dirt.
Then... Attack the host from behind, but
what? Aeschylus asked. But I'm not sure how this could be possible. The strength, they...
Aeschylus and Harnilas exchanged a worried glance. The captain looked up, gazed at the young king in a fixed manner officers use to humble subordinates. Without breaking eye contact, he said, Atham Suti Sal Maretan, to the mandate schoolman beside him. Then he continued, and Shaikh, spoken slowly enough for Sorwheel to follow. So, what would you do?
The young king of Sarkarpus shrugged. Ride hard for the Aspect Emperor.
The old officer smiled and nodded, slapped him on the shoulder before bawling for camp to be broken.
So, it is possible?
Sorwheel asked Aeschylus, who remained beside him, watching with a strange, almost fatherly gleam in his eyes.
The strength could be doing what I think?
The schoolman crushed his beard into his barrel chest, nodding. In ancient times, before the coming of the no-god, the consult would harness the strength, chain them into great assemblies that the ancient Nocerai called yokes. He paused, blinking, as though to pinch away unwanted memories. They would drive them away the way we drive slaves in the three seas, starve them until their hungers reached a fever pitch. Then, when they reached a position where the shrank could smell mannish blood on the wind, they would strike the chains and let them run. Something within the Sarkarpi king, a binding of fear and hope, slumped in relief.
He almost reeled for exhaustion, as if alarm alone has sustained him through all the sleepless watches.
The schoolman steadied him with a hand on his shoulder.
"My king?"
Sorweel shook his head to dismiss the sorcerer's worry.
He looked out across the morning plain. Sekarpis could be directly behind him instead of weeks away, for all the difference the horizon made.
"The captain," he said, returning to the sorcerer's gaze. "What did he say to you just then?"
"That you possess the gifts of a great king," Aeschylus replied, squeezing his shoulder the way his father had, whenever he took pride in his son's accomplishments.
"Gifts?" Something within him wanted to cry. "No."
"Only things that the dirt had told him."